while operating in the area southeast of New Britain between 5 degrees 15 minutes south and 6 degrees 0 minutes south and west of so forth during her third patrol, Argonaut, Lieutenant Commander Pierce intercepted a Japanese convoy returning to Rabaul from Leahy on 10 January 43. A U.S. Army plane, which was out of bombs, saw one destroyer hit by a torpedo, saw the explosion of two other destroyers, and reported that there were five other vessels in the group. After a severe depth charge attack, Argonaut was forced to surface, and destroyers, according to the plane's report, circled and pumped shells into her bow, which was stacking up at a considerable angle. The action took place at 5 degrees so forth, and further efforts to contact Argonaut by radio was fruitless. It was quite certain that the Argonaut met her end in this action. Japanese reports made the available since the end of the war record this attack as a depth charge attack followed by artillery fire, which the destroyed top of the sub floated. Argonaut's first patrol near Midway had resulted in no damage to enemy ships, but his second was the most successful one. It conducted the following complete modernization at Mare Island. Her mission on this one had been to cooperate with Nautilus in transporting 252 Marine officers and men to make an island for a diversionary raid against enemy shores installations. In the early morning of 17 August 1943, the raiders were debarked to boats. After nearly 2 days ashore, the Marines returned and the submarine transported them back to Pearl Harbor. On the basis of reports given by the Army flyer which witnessed the attack, as which the Argonaut perished, the ship was credited with having damaged one Japanese destroyer on her last patrol. I can tell you when you sunk ships and then you started evasive action as far as depth charging was as involved. It's quite an experience, and a lot of us had to change our drawers immediately. But if you had a good skipper, they were able to do maneuvering to fool the Japanese destroyers. And one of the things we found out that, and I still to this day can't figure it out, the Japanese would have us in their sights, and you'd count when you'd hear the click of a 45, then you'd count 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005. The more you could count, the further away were the up charges. But if you got to one and two and then you heard the up charges, you had a lot of problems. And, of course, Hollywood shows everything being torn up and down, busted out, which isn't so. I mean, certain things would happen on some of the boats, so they imploded instead of because of depth charging. But we always had a good skipper, and I can remember the first time that I was in a depth charge attack. I looked over to this buddy of mine, and I said, "What gives?" And he looked at me, and he says, "Don't worry." He says, "We'll get out of here. We got a good skipper." And so, you know, the old story was misery loves company. So we're all in the same boat, but it's we went into a silent running where we turned everything completely off, and everything went into hand power. And it would get up to be 120, 130 degrees. And so the longest we were down one time was 30 hours. And we finally got away. And we had very little oxygen left in the boat when we surfaced. But that was just one of the things that happened. But that's so I know what these guys went through. The Argonaut, the Swordfish, 145. Swordfish, SS-193. Swordfish under Commander Montrose left Pearl Harbor on 22 December 1944 to carry on her 13th patrol in the vicinity of the Nansi Shoto. She topped off with fuel at Midway and on 26 December and left that day for Hariri. In addition to her regular patrol, Swordfish was to conduct photographic reconnaissance of Okinawa for preparation of the Okinawa campaign. On 2 January, Swordfish was ordered to delay carrying out assigned tasks in order to keep her clear of the Nasi Shoto area until completion of carrier-based air strikes, which were scheduled. She was directed to patrol the general vicinity, so forth, until further orders was received. In the last communication received from the Swordfish, she acknowledged receipt of these orders on 3 January. On 9 January 1945, Swordfish was directed to proceed to the vicinity of Okinawa to carry out a special mission. It was estimated that the task would not take more than 7 days after arrival on station, which she should have had reached on 11 January. On completion of her mission, Swordfish was to proceed to Saipan or to Midway if she was unable to transmit by radio. Since neither places had seen her by 15 February and repeated attempts to raise her by radio had failed, she was reported as presumed lost on that date. In the report of a loss, mention was made that Kate, which was at that time patrolling the vicinity of Okinawa, reported that on the morning of 12 January, she contacted the submarine by radar. It was believed that the contact was with Swordfish, since it was so forth. 4 hours later, Kate heard heavy depth charging from the area, and it was believed that this attack might have been the cause of the Swordfish's loss. Japanese information on anti-submarine attacks does not mention the attack heard by Kate on 12 January, and records no attacks to which the Swordfish is likely to have been the victim. However, it was now known that there were many mines planted around Okinawa since the Japanese were expected as Allied invasion of that island. The majority of the mines were placed close in. It is considered about equally likely the Swordfish was sunk by depth charge attacks before she reached Okinawa. Swordfish is in the 12th patrol between her fatal 13th, sank 21 ships amounting to 113,000 tons and damaged an additional 8 totaling 46,000 tons. Her first patrol began the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and she was conducted west of the Philippines. Swordfish was sank 4 freighters varying from 38,000 tons to 9,000 tons and damaged the 5th. At the time, there was most estimated patrol, the most successful patrol in the war. I'm not going to go to the rest of it. It's another page, but that talks about her. Let's go about the others. SS-36 and the SS-26. I served on an S-boat, and every time we pull the plug, I'd say my prayers, because it was really scary. You didn't know whether you could have come back up or not. And everyone was looking at everyone else and saying, hope we get it. Let's see. 36,
36, 19. As far as diving and services, I never knew anybody that celebrated when they dove. Unless they were seasick.
SS-36. On a second patrol starting on 30 December 1941, S-36 had completed one daring, successful attack on a small transport moored in Calapan Harbor, Philippines. She proceeded to Surabaya, Java, in accordance with instructions received from CONSUB when at 0404 on 20 January 42, S-36 grounded on Taka Bakan in the reef Madagascar Straits, west of the southern Celebes. Her forward battery flooded and appeared to be generating chlorine gas, and the situation grave enough to Lieutenant McKnight, commanding officer, to necessitate sending out a plain language message that she was aground and sinking. Sago, nearing Surabaya, received the message and tried to relay it, but after 5 hours of unsuccessful trying, she returned back to help the S-36. When headquarters at Surabaya finally received the message, sorry, returned there, and a PBY plane was sent to us to ascertain certain conditions. By the time the plane arrived, commanding officer felt that with assistance he could salvage the ship, and none of the crew were transferred to the plane at that time, and it went to Madagascar City to request assistance from Dutch authorities. The next morning, a launch arrived from Madagascar, and two officers and 28 men were transferred to her, and the remainder of the crew stayed on board in hope that the S-36 might be hauled clear. Conditions became progressively worse, and when the Dutch ship Ciabatti arrived on the afternoon of 21 January 42, the commanding officer decided to abandon the ship and destroy her. All officers and men were saved and arrived at Surabaya. The first patrol of the S-36 had been productive of no sinkings, but for the patrol in which she was lost, she was credited with a $5,000 ship sunk. That was her, and it was something. Let's see the S-26. S-26. Lieutenant Commander Hawk was lost at 22:33 on 24 January 1942 in the Gulf of Panama, about 14 miles west of San Jose Light in 300 feet of water. There were three survivors, two officers and one who was the commanding officer, and one enlisted man. The people were on the bridge at the time of the collision. Fourth person on the bridge, enlisted man, was lost. Just to digress, when we dove one time with the hatch open, and when we got down to 650 feet, we finally got control and we proceeded up, but we didn't know whether we were going to make it to the top. And when we got on the surface, the skipper called all the officers into the wardroom, and he said, "We're not taking the so-and-so back. We're going to repair everything we have because we're lying dead in the water. Who wants to take the bridge?" And I said, "I'll take the bridge." And he says, "Okay." And he said, "How long do you want to stay up there?" I said, "I stay up there as long as until we get underway." One guy says, "Maybe 24 hours. I said, "Right." I said, "At least I'm topside. I'm topside. At least I'm topside. If I go over this, I got a chance of going over the side. If I'm down here, I'm not going to be going with you guys. I'm going to be in the water." And they couldn't understand it, but that's the way I always felt. S-26 was proceeding from Balboa to its patrol station in company with the S-21, S-29, and the S-44 and an escort vessel. At 22:10 was the escort vessel sent a visual message to the submarines that she was leaving the formation and they would proceed on duty assigned. S-21 was the only submarine to receive the message. Shortly thereafter, PC-460 struck S-26 on the starboard side of the torpedo room and the submarine sank within a few seconds. Salvage operations started immediately. And attempts to rescue were made, but without success. The submarine was not raised. She had previously made one more patrol and inflicted damage on the. Now that's the story on that. I've got to tell you something. It's real interesting because when I received my commission and went to, and I want you to know, I've been on both sides of the fence, so I know what it is. And I got to say this, even though I had the stripes, the majority of my friends today are enlisted like you guys, because it's really something. And I get a little choked up because even when Don called me, I said, "This is a great organization, and it's just something to be part of this organization." I want you to know that. But anyway, we were called in the wardroom, and the captain had. I had served with the captain before when I was enlisted, and he was the one that recommended me for a promotion. And so we're sitting there, and we're getting assignments, and he said, "Jack," he says, "you'll stand JOD watches," and Hale Taylor, a new ensign, came aboard, and he says, "Well, Captain, I just got out of the academy," and the captain says, "So what?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I think I should be get a little better service or something." And the captain says, "Taylor, I don't know you. I don't know what you're like or something. You're going to stay JOD watches as well." So we got the Saipan, and before we got the Saipan, Taylor says we only had enough staterooms that one officer would have to sleep on the transom in the wardroom. And so he says, "Well, I'm from the academy, so I can, got to stay there." I said, "Wait a minute, Charlie." I said, I didn't get off the boat yesterday. I said, "What's your service number?" And this is a true story. I said, "Because service numbers, you outrank. I mean, if you, So he says, my service number is 331-607. I says, really? Isn't this interesting? Mine's 331-606, so that's a true story. And he looked at me, and I says, Taylor, you're sleeping on the transfer. I'm going to be in the state room. We became good friends, but I never forget that. I looked at him, and he says, no. And you know the whole thing, when you're in the service, it wasn't what you knew, it was who you knew. When you stopped it, when you look back, and like I said before, the chiefs are what make the chiefs are what make the Navy. You take all the brass in the world. Washington does not like submarines. The Navy Department, you know, we're having a battle to keeping the submarine force in effect, because a lot of them, they're all interested in our carriers. And that was so in the beginning of the war. And at the beginning of the war, there was a big turnover of skippers on submarines because they were chicken. You know, when you got out on patrol, we had a lot of them in firing torpedoes and you know, torpedo attack. You had to get between 1,200 and 1,500 yards to really get a decent shot off. And some of these guys wanted to fire their torpedoes at 4,000 and 5,000. Well, forget it. I mean, I've seen torpedoes hit the side of a ship and explode, and all you see is a steam of water. They didn't explode at all. And my one skipper that I wanted to go with, he got relieved of command because he complained too much. We had to use that deck gun several times. But because at the very beginning of the war, very few people knew about the exploder mechanism on the torpedoes, except a few guys back in Washington. And it was really something, but it proved to be, came out. And when we first got radar, the radar broke down more than we could use it. And it was an interesting life, I can tell you that. And so it's just great, that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much, Barry.